Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show this week, it's a BPG special as the Broadcasting Press Guild celebrates 50 years of service. We bring together two board members to discuss the future of the sector. Also on the programme, All Three Media finally gets bought. Why does Jeff Zucker want to purchase it for his UAE-based media empire? All that plus we look at why the current affairs magazines are all having a bit of a blip. And in the media quiz, we manifest the media headlines of the future. That's all coming up in this edition of the Media Podcast. In the news this week, Dan Wooden has been cleared of alleged criminal behaviour after the Met Police ended a six-month investigation into the former GB News presenter. Wooden put out a statement saying the investigations into his private life had been a politically motivated witch hunt through the left wing and social media. The Independent newspaper is in talks to pick up BuzzFeed and HuffPost in the UK and Ireland, according to The Guardian. BuzzFeed founder and CEO Jonah Peretti told UK staff of his excitement about the partnership we are exploring with The Independent. And it's farewell then to Keith from The Office. Actor Ewan McIntosh died this week. He was 50 years old. Tributes were led by Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant, Gervais calling him an absolute original. Now, joining me at the London Podcast Studios are two guest pundits that have one thing in common. Well, maybe more than one thing, we'll find out. But they're both members of the Broadcasting Press Guild who celebrate their 50th year in 2024. And making her media podcast debut, it's Caroline Frost, columnist at the Radio Times. Hello.
Hello.
Outside of the day job, board member of the Guild, and it's been quite a busy time.
Yes, it has. It's been a time for looking forward. We have a brand new chair, Minori. And we are also looking backwards because we're celebrating our half century, 50 years of broadcasting press coming together, talking about the best of TV and radio. So this is a year for celebrating all that's new, all that's come our way in 2023, but also really very much doffing our cap to all those years and years of entertainment.
And there's going to be a big list.
Yes, there is. This is our special award for our 50th anniversary. We are looking back over those past 50 years. We've invited all our guild members to mark up. I think we gave them the choice of about four landmark programmes during all of that time that really did make the difference to their lives and they thought shifted the wheel on broadcasting generally. And it has thrown up some extraordinarily diverse titles. What we've learned is that lots of people have very strong and very different opinions about what makes good TV and radio.
Well, this is the first year that I've been able to participate. And it is, there's some interesting names on there and they're from quite different parts of the TV spectrum. So it's quite hard to compare.
It's apples and pears. Mm. Did you go down a comedic line or a documentary line or entertainment or big budget drama? Which took you?
I tried to pick things which had sort of real impact on me and the sector.
This is lovely. This is honey to our ears. This is so involved. I'm really appreciating the investment and I just wish all our guild members, and I'm sure they are just as invested in the outcome as you are.
So I'm sure they're also
great example.
We're TV fans. And also welcome back down the line from a snowy Colorado, media writer and yes, BPG board member Kate Bulkley. Hi, Kate.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, thank you. It looks lovely in your backdrop. You definitely win the prize for the backdrop. So if you're listening to this on audio, do check us out our YouTube channel so you can see the lovely vistas. The BPG, it's an interesting group of people, isn't it, who get to take part in these events?
Yes, it's a big group of people. And in fact, the BPG has been going for quite a long time now. It started in 1974 as a breakaway body from the critics' circle. And in the early days, we used to have our awards luncheon in a pub. We've now moved on a bit, and we now get a little more glamorous venues. But it's a big group. It goes up and down in terms of membership. But right now, we have over 110 members. These are all people that write or broadcast about the media sector in the UK. So they could be program critics, they could be business media writers, they are editors, and they cover the whole gamut of the titles, you know, the big broadsheets. It's also some of the smaller trade publications, as well as some of the bigger trade publications like Variety and Deadline, Hollywood Reporter. We also have The Telegraph, The Guardian, everyone really is part of the guild, and which is what makes it so interesting, because it's really across the board. And as you were saying, in terms of how we vote, you know, journalists tend to be rather opinionated, and they are all fans of television and audio, so we get lots of good opinions. So it's a lot of fun.
Well, lots of opinions on today's show as well, I hope. Lots of good stories. BBC Director General Tim Davey has been in front of MPs this week. He told the Public Accounts Committee that he welcomes the licence fee settlement. Kate, was he right to do that?
Well, I think he was right in the sense that that's, he sort of had to. Is this a government decree? Creed to a certain extent. I mean, how much you're going to fight. I think the other thing that he pointed out, which I also agree with, is that at least he's got some kind of certainty for how much money the BBC gets for the next few years. In this current volatile media environment, I mean, the advertising market is really in its worst state since 2008. It's, you know, we're seeing job cuts across all media organizations, certainly broadcasting media organizations, are under a lot of pressure. So I think, you know, the if there's a silver lining to a lower settlement, it's the fact that at least there's some certainty over the next 4 to 6 years. So that's the good news. The bad news is obviously he didn't get a license fee increase by £15 a year. He only got £10 a year across the board. So he's got, you know, less millions, so to speak, to work with. And he also realizes he has to cut some costs. I think they're looking to cut £500 million, which is, you know, a lot of money. And we're seeing a lot of the cuts already, certainly in their news output. They've had to merge their international and their domestic news channels. You've seen some cuts, for example, with Newsnight. So there are things like that that are going on that are obviously aren't good. But I guess the upside is at least they have some certainty. You look at what's happening at Channel 4, at Paramount, which is the owner of Channel 5. All these companies are having a lot of pressure. ITV, similar situation. I
mean, Caroline, Kate's right, isn't she? Everyone's sort of facing the pinch. And maybe the BBC, who've sort of been through the mill over the last 10 years, are in a relatively good position. So at least they know their money's kind of in the bank.
I think the word that you used that was key there was relatively. So for sure. I mean, I used to work for the BBC for a long time. Many of my friends still work there across all sorts of different areas of the ecosystem, and each of them have independently said to me that theirs is the area that is receiving the most cuts.
Right.
So that tells you something about how broad the cull really is and how much of a difference it's making. Pretty dramatic for those individuals involved. But as you say, compared with that volatility, as Kate said, of the independent sector and the commercial sector, it still represents a safe house of some description. I mean, the money's little, but it's secured. It's a bit like taking your bets with a tracker mortgage or a fixed rate, isn't it? I mean, I guess everybody will have a different sensibility. But for sure, I mean, such depressing news coming out at the beginning of the year about Channel 4 after all its roller coaster ride of the last 2 years. I would still, if I were starting out as some sort of newbie, I mean, only a few years ago, obviously. I would still want to go and try my luck at the BBC because the training is still there. Some of the things that we hold dear exist, but clearly they're under threat. I feel like instinctively I trust Tim Davey. He's put a good spin on something. He said he's pleased about something that he fought desperately only a few months previously, but at least they go into the future knowing what the purse looks like.
They do. And Kate, obviously massive impact because of the commissioning downturn on individuals, on freelancers in the sector, on small production companies. Lots of talk about people who can sort of jumping into the film world where there seems to be a bit more work available. Is that something you're hearing is happening more?
So what's interesting about this, Matt, is that, you know, only a few years ago we were talking about peak TV and premium television. And the idea was that anyone who was anybody, whether you were an actor or a grip or a director or a producer or a writer, were all diving into television because, of course, the money was all being spent in television. You had Netflix pouring billions into it. You had Prime. You had everybody from this, let's say, more legacy media companies, be it the BBC or ITV, realizing they had to up their game in order to get talent, to get stuff on screen. Now we're seeing that, you know, obviously there's, let's say, a different focus among the streaming media companies, including the big tech companies, because they realize they have to just not just throw money at the screen to make it work. They actually have to have some kind of profit or think about not just gaining new subscribers, but what are they actually making on the other end. So there's been a lot more focus, not only from the big tech companies, but also from the legacy media companies. You know, we've seen a lot of mergers going on, and that has to do with the fact that they're trying to think, how can we make a critical mass that will make this new streaming business work economically. So are people starting to go back to film? Yes and no. I mean, film is also a difficult environment as well. I mean, look at how many people are going to movie theaters. We're still seeing a lot of, you know, a lot of money spent at the top end of film, sort of these big budget franchises, you know, the Marvel, yet another Marvel film. And then we have stuff at the low end. The middle part of the film business is still, you know, having a really hard time, because it's like, where do you put your stuff? Where do you get your talent? How do you get it out there? So I don't think either one is better than the other right now. I mean, I think that we're seeing a little bit more of a recalibration, if I can say that, in terms of it's not just everybody bouncing into premium television, but we're also, it's not getting so much better in film, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So yes, we're starting to see a little bit of a recalibration, but both are under pressure. But we still need good content to make these services work. So we're still going to see a lot of content commission, just maybe not as much, and certainly maybe not as big budget.
Caroline?
I think it's quite revealing just how many what we used to consider big screen film stars are continuing their exodus to the small screen. And I think it is finding that middle area that Kate identified, because Marvel up on the big screen, big indie film sector, both very healthy, thriving, perhaps Marvel with a few asterisks and caveats in recent times. But in terms of the storytelling, the character-led dramas, I'm thinking of the likes of Nicole Kidman, I'm thinking of Meryl Streep, I'm thinking of Steve Martin, all finding homes on streaming platforms particularly. There's money and they're giving them creative control. Well, they're partnering with production companies. And then you get somebody like Martin Scorsese, who's despairing of the way the film world has gone. He's one of the great titans over the last, 30, 40 years. And even he, when he brings his offerings first, for first refusal, first dibs, from the likes of Netflix, Apple, then you know that something really quite defining is shifting.
I've just been watching Jodie Foster in True Detective.
So the last time she was on a TV show was in the 1970s.
Yes, yeah, so nearly 50 years since she's done TV.
Still fantastic.
It's an amazing series. Nice and spooky as well. Mm-hmm. But it does show, doesn't it? There's that... And perhaps it's the streamers that have encouraged this, is what is film, what is television, whether you're working behind the scenes or in front of the camera. It's far less split than it's ever been before.
It's morphed, hasn't it? I mean, this word content that used to be a swear word in these parts is now pretty much the only accurate way of describing what we're seeing. And particularly the way things are first, they get this tiny, tiny theatrical window to qualify for awards. But then really, it's all about the streaming platforms and the big numbers of eyeballs that you can get on your product, the other swear word.
Well, speaking of content, the BBC's head of unscripted programmes, Kate Phillips, spoke to Broadcast this week. Her mantra, which has often been heard, is fewer, bigger, better. Caroline, do you know how that's going to manifest itself?
Well, I guess, does she mean another series of Survivor?
Probably not.
Bated breath.
Yes.
Yes, I mean, if you look at some of the ways that the money has been spent in recent times, we're seeing a bit more of the Gladiator type show and a bit less of the Greg Wallace in a hairnet variety. So I guess that is definitely bigger. I don't know if it's better. See Survivor, see if it comes back. She said that there is still room for the smaller products, but she also highlighted the fact that she's really enjoying so many shows making their big break, their debut in daytime. And I guess that's the kind of the shallow end of the swimming pool. Throw it up the flagpole in daytime, see if it grabs an audience, as we saw so happen so successfully with the likes of The Repair Shop.
Yes.
And then perhaps with an idea to moving it into evening viewing.
I mean, she's had quite a good run recently, hasn't she?
She has had a good run, and in two very different ways. Off the top of my head, I'm thinking of something the size, the epic nature of Gladiators, which is an unashamed reboot, but has found an audience at the weekend, getting harder and harder to
and
find those
audience,
audiences.
And a real sort of Strictly style bit of everyone.
This is the holy grail. This is what everyone wants to know. How is the BBC going to follow Strictly? And perhaps Gladiators has given it something of an answer. But then equally, you get a talent like Stacey Solomon, who has emerged from reality show background into the loose woman avenue of character development and now has found her own space. So I think that there is definitely room in that sphere for big and for small, and that's clearly very encouraging.
Kate, I mean, some smaller indies have taken the BBC to task for kind of recommissioning old formats like Gladiators. Is that fair criticism?
Well, you know, I think we've got a lot of noise out there in the media landscape right now, Matt. So if you're a broadcaster and you're trying to get attention, if you can find a franchise that works, you're going to lean into it. I mean, that's just economics. So, yeah, maybe, you know, if you're an independent producer and you've got one of those franchises, you say, yes, fantastic. If you don't have one, then you might be not so happy about that. As what Caroline just said, you know, how many reboots can we take of things? But on the other hand, sometimes we come up with something that's completely, you think, really, is this really that different? And yet, The Traitors is a good example. I mean, that's a factual entertainment show. But I mean, you know, who knew there was going to be another big factual entertainment show? And yet they've managed to make it look different, feel different, have a different, you know, whatever vibe. And so it's a great franchise. So I think that, you know, you can't sort of say, well, it's terrible that they're looking for franchises, because that's the way you have to make the economics work. You need a couple of those at least to make things work. You need a Strictly, you need a Bake Off, you need a Traitors, you need something to sort of get the audience and have it. It's like a tentpole. It's a tentpole show that's going to give your service or your channel some kind of, I don't know, currency.
I mean, Caroline, sort of attention's important, isn't it?
It is, but despite the familiarity of a reboot, it's still no guarantee. So yes. Gladiators, fantastic, whole new faces, familiar but exotic and different. Survivor has not found that same purchase, and that, in theory, on a piece of paper, would seem to tick very similar boxes.
I mean, Survivor's it's had a lot of success around the world. UK's had a couple of goes at it. Mm-hmm. I'm a Celebrity is similar. They were sued by them right at the beginning. It's weird. It just hasn't really taken.
This is why you just don't know nothing, as they say. I mean, as Kate said, who knew that Traitors would take off? But it has. They're now planning a Celebrity version later in the year. I mean, yet to be commissioned, they've been quick to say, but I think we know that will come.
It's guaranteed, isn't it?
I mean, perhaps that's what they need to do, make a Celebrity edition of Survivor. I mean, there are a few people I can think that I'd quite like to send to a desert island. But you just don't know, which is why when they do land on something and it does well, you can see why they iterate. I mean, until they're blue in the face and they sort of squeeze. To my mind, I always get a bit depressed when I see one iteration too many of a successful franchise. I'm thinking of the likes, you know, the Bake Offs. We've had the Celebrity version, we had the Junior version, and you do feel as though the orange has been squeezed dry.
And then it's into sewing and it's sort of similar topics.
Well, that's all. I mean, I would call that a whole era of kindness. And it's quite interesting that we had something like Bake Off turned up and sort of swept away Kitchen Nightmares, X Factor, all that kind of elbows out gladiatorial combat in primetime TV. And then you had this kind era of the sewing bee, the embroideries, the baking. And now, of course, we see that The Apprentice is finding a whole new audience, which means perhaps we're ready for a bit more elbows out.
The pendulum swings backs and forwards.
It does.
Even something like Traitors, okay, it's got more of an edge, but it's a game and it's the stakes are lower for everybody. It's not as mean as some of the reality TV was in the early noughties.
I think it's reassuringly meaningless, frankly, isn't it? I mean, what does it come down to? Yes, there's a little pot of gold at the end of the show, but frankly, it's just about, what is it? It's Wink Murder, isn't it? By any other name?
I don't know if you've seen the Australian version compared to the UK version.
Yes.
So for listeners at home, same if Kate, you've seen that. But the Australian version, it's a bit more like The Apprentice. The characters sort of come on going, I'm the best, I'm going to find who these people are. Whereas in the UK, it's very much, I'm having a lovely time, you're all my friends. And it's interesting how you can reinterpret a format in those two different ways.
Yes, the Australian one has not been as successful to anything like the extent that the UK one has enjoyed. So, and they're actually, a bunch of people in Australia have picked up and they are now watching Traitors UK in the way that many people in the UK really enjoy MasterChef Australia. Yes. So the good news is horses for courses.
I mean, Kate, that's interesting, isn't it, about sort of repurposing formats. So the last 50 years, TV companies have pretended that shows are their own when really they've been imported in from somewhere, even for sort of University Challenge way back when. Whereas now, if you love something, you can consume it all. And I'm thinking of some of the Drag Race stuff or things like The Traitors.
Well, it's true. I having grown up in America and then moved to Britain 35 years ago, so many of my American friends say, oh, yes, you know, this show was invented here. And of course, it's a UK format that's just been formatted for the US market. And they have no idea that it came originally from the UK. And now, of course, with streaming and global distribution much easier now, they will sometimes now watch the original show and think, oh, isn't that nice? The UK have made a show based on the US show. Like, no, this is the original. So, it's definitely more of a global marketplace, that is for sure.
Well, speaking of formats, the news broke last Friday that All Three Media, somebody who's very much in the format world, has been bought by Redbird IMI. That's the same group who might acquire the Telegraph Group for about £1 billion. Kate, they've been up for sale for a while. They're a big company. This is a pretty big deal.
Oh, it's a very big deal. And in fact, I wrote about it a couple of times last year, sort of saying, okay, what is going to happen? Because the ITV, for example, was one of the early bidders. They came in with, I think it was about $750 million they wanted to pay for it and were turned flatly down. And then, of course, Redbird came in, Redbird IMI, and they agreed a deal for sort of $1.2 billion. It's interesting because Redbird is on an acquisition spree. It's an interesting company. It's got Jeff Zucker, who, of course, came from CNN and NBC Universal. He's teamed up with another fellow who's from the television business, and the money is coming from Abu Dhabi, International Media Investments. Basically, it's a way, it's called a roll-up in the business, in business world, and what they're trying to do is they're trying to buy a lot of independent production companies that own formats or were making cool things. They bought Media Res, for example. It doesn't surprise me this is happening. It sort of surprised me that actually Discovery and Liberty sold it for $1.2 billion. I mean, I think they could have waited and gotten a higher price, in my opinion. Because it is a big company, and they've got all kinds of stuff. I mean, everything from, you know, Studio Lambert, which, of course, produces all kinds of things, including Squid Game, which is obviously a big show. They own Two Brothers Pictures. They own Silverback Films. It's a huge warehouse of independent production companies that produce programs that work all around the world. So it's an interesting thing. I don't think we're going to see less of this. I think we're going to see more acquisitions. It's just a question of who's going to be doing the acquiring. And obviously, when you've got a Redbird IMI, which has, let us say, an endless bank account because they've got such big backers, I mean, it's a very interesting moment for the television business to see who are going to be hoovering these things up. It's not necessarily going to be the Hollywood studios, right? It's going to be these outside groups that are being formed to do something different.
So just on that, why is it that sort of cash is coming in to do this rather than it going to a traditional content company or a platform? People who want to fill up, you would have thought, want to fill up their streaming services with new content.
Yeah, I think they do. I think that I have a view on this. I think that there are some people that believe that the way to make a profitable media business going forward is to be vertically integrated, to own the platform that distributes the content and to also own the content itself. And that's called a vertically integrated model. There's another school of thought that maybe you want to just own one thing. So you want to be a content creator, producer, owner, and then you sell to these platforms. That's more of a single line of business. You see what I mean? And then there's the other. So line of business, which I don't think works at all, is where you're just a platform and you don't actually own content and you don't own content creation. So there's sort of three ways to look at what's the best model going forward. And I think we're in a time now where everyone's trying to readjust their thinking about what works. We went through an era where everybody thought vertical integration was the way to go. I think we're now beginning to see that perhaps owning both the content and the platform doesn't necessarily work. So it's expensive, it's risky. Maybe it's better to be a platform only. Maybe it's better to be a content producer only. So I think that's what we're starting to see, a distinction in what actually works economically. Because the numbers are so high and the competition is so intense. And we're dealing with what I call big tech. You know, we've got the big global tech platforms. And I mean Amazon, I mean, you know, Netflix, I mean, you know, these companies who have deep pockets and they are throwing money at video content in order to make their streaming services work. And yet they're part of bigger operations, so they don't have to have the same kind of economic, let's say, dollars and cents that, say, a Warner Brothers Discovery has to. That's the other thing that's happening. We're going to see more roll-ups between the streaming platforms and the legacy media sector. We know that already there's huge rumors that Paramount's on the block and will get hoovered up by either split up and hoovered up by different people or become part of another media conglomerate. So I think, you know, it's all about, you know, what is going to work economically going forward in this very difficult time. Advertising's down. Subscriptions are up. IP streaming is there, but how many subscriptions are people going to want? I mean, it's a very interesting moment in the media business. There's a lot of demand, and yet there's so much supply. How do you stand out?
Caroline, I was sort of trying to trace back all three, and it sort of goes back to Chrysalis TV. And, you know, is it good that money's coming in to fund organizations that are based here quite a lot, or is it bad news that we're losing the ownership of it?
I think it's great news if you're in production.
Yep.
As we've heard for the last couple of years, we've seen the huge spend from Disney, from Warner Brothers. I mean, studios are being built to just accommodate all this massive development. It's interesting listening to what Kate had to say, because I was reminded of when Reed Hastings spoke at the TV festival a couple of years ago, and Kirsty Walk put him on the spot, and she reminded him, as the CEO of Netflix, that if you're not looking at the menu, you're probably on the menu. Now, of course, you look at something like Netflix, and for the past decade, they seem to have had money to burn. And of course, they pioneered their original content with the likes of House of Cards, Orange is the New
Black.
But
a lot of that was being scared, isn't it, of suddenly people stopping selling them things.
And as came to pass with the likes of The Friends, enormous renaissance, a never-ending audience of Friends disappearing because Warner Brothers, everybody else started getting their act together and developing their own streaming platforms. But then you look at the pie of actual available production and development money, and Netflix is dwarfed. It's a little sliver of cake compared with, as Kate mentioned, the likes of Apple, and the big whopper is Amazon. And so I can see why people would just think, let's just marry up, because it's the only way to survive in those whale-infested waters.
Whilst we look at the whales, we'll be back for more media news after this.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back. Kate and Caroline are here for some more news in brief. There's been a wobble in the current affairs magazine market, according to the latest ABCs. Caroline, we've seen drops for Private Eye, The Economist, The Week, Prospect. A lot of these titles have often defied the print narrative. What's been happening?
Well, let's just take Private Eye, one of the great rediscovered success stories of lockdown.
I think.
Anecdotally, lots of people continued. Lots of people took out subscriptions because they were stuck at home, and Private Eye was a little bit of, I guess, relief in that strange era. But yes, I mean, it's still doing well, you know, still up in the hundreds of thousands, which is nothing to complain about in this era. But as you say, all taking a dip, I would just posit cost of living. I think it's a luxury that some people, when they're looking at their household bills, just think, do I really need a current affairs magazine when I can get all my news for free from so many different sources? I mean,
there is a thing with subscriptions. You think about your magazine subscription the same way as a TV subscription. We were going through our subscriptions at home recently, and we got like a meal box service, and you sort of put them all in the same bunch, don't you?
That's very decadent in this day and age.
It's the cheap
a
one.
Meal box.
It's Simply Cook. It's tenner a month. It's excellent.
Okay.
But you sort of...
Yes.
Everything's sort of swappable, isn't it?
It is, I guess. But as I say, when you have free alternatives, I mean, nothing like the quality of each of those. And there's a reason that their print numbers perhaps are going down, but their digital subscriptions, as we'll get onto, are going up, is because it's part of a controlled migration. So some of the digital figures will be the relief and also the planned for numbers that all of those publishers are hoping for. But I do think it's a sad day. I mean, the day we've seen so many magazines go the way of digital. We saw the likes of NME moving from weekly to sort of less regularly to then, next thing you know, will be a digital offering only. And of course, those of us who remember the sweet smell of a new magazine plopping through the letterbox, Jackie. I mean, what's happened to Jackie? It's a sad day, but I think as long as those who have successfully migrated, I don't think they have anything to fear. It's the ones who haven't played catch up and are perhaps having to try. And because I think that we have reached peak digital subscription as well.
Kate, is this also connected to how people feel about the news? Are we in a sort of slight interregnum before we hit election fever and people are wanting to opt out of the news?
Ooh, people wanting to opt out of the news. God, I hope not. Good heavens, we need them to be reading more news, not opting out. I think my opinion would be a little bit like what Caroline's saying. I mean, the migration from a printed magazine or newspaper to a print to a digital magazine or newspaper is inevitable, and it's inevitable because of the cost of producing these printed editions. It just doesn't make any sense anymore. And the magazines that have done the best, of course, are The Economist, has a huge amount of digital subscriptions. They have a paywall and they're making a lot of money. In fact, they're always held up as kind of the poster child for how you do it right, if you do a digital version. But yeah, it's like what Caroline says. Some of them don't make it because they either don't figure it out quick enough, or they don't know how to make the digital thing work, or they don't know how to migrate their consumers to the digital version. You got to remember that this is a huge shift for the media business, having to actually know who your readers are and your subscribers are. In the old days, you sort of put your newspaper out in a newsstand. You didn't know who was buying it. You just knew that they were going to read the ads. And so you were really talking more to your ad people than you were to your consumers, your end consumers. This is a very different game. You have to know who your consumers are, when they want to see or read you, you know, where they're going to find you, all that kind of stuff. So it's a very different world that we're looking at here. And I hope that they're all reading something online or otherwise, because if they don't, then democracy's in peril. That would be my bottom line on that.
I mean, Caroline, Kate mentioned The Economist there, and digital sales are up for The Economist. Is that just because they know who their audience is and a product they're delivering and it works well in the digital realm?
I think that there are fewer competitors. They're completely specialist. They're regarded as the market leaders. They are the experts of their content, of their sector. And I think perhaps it's one of those lucky stars that if you were looking, I will never be a financial economist in any sense, but if I were, and I thought, well, it's almost as though I wouldn't be able to do that job without taking that particular title. They're lucky. They've secured that position through many, many years of graft, of building their brand.
Investment.
A total investment. And of course, with the advertising that they get at that high end and that sector, they probably have a little bit more disposable income to turn it around and to continue to invest. So they will only carry on winning, I would predict. Whereas, I mean, I wouldn't want to be a financial magazine starting up in this day and age, unless you go only digital and you create something completely different.
Something bespoke. And did you ever think you're going to jack in the Radio Times, just go all Substack and just make all your readers pay for you?
Oh, do you know, if there was a brief window, I think, when I had to sort out my own freehold mortgage and I became for a whole week a complete expert in all things freehold, and I thought, oh, I could do this, and then of course everything just fell out the back and was replaced with more important things like TV shows once again.
Some changes to the radio schedules are coming. Radio 1 announced that Jordan North would be replaced by Jamie Lang, which hasn't gone down well in some radio circles. And North is off to do Capital Radio's breakfast show, replacing Roman Kemp. Jamie Lang, interesting character, Caroline, has actually done radio for quite a long time. I saw it pop up, a friend posted about him sort of starting off in Heat Radio about 10 years ago. Why has he caused so much consternation?
Oh, I just think poor old Jamie Lang, everything just comes a little bit too easily, in sense of he is the McVitie's heir. I mean, he will never be short of money or biscuits. But we know that he was in Strictly until he lasted the whole launch show and broke his leg. So I don't think things come as easily for him as perhaps it would appear. There has been a bit of backlash, anecdotally, I've seen in recent weeks about reality stars taking on the airwaves generally. I think those days of the regional jocks doing their time, doing the graveyard shifts, turning up week after week for that hard-working but rewardless midnight to 4 a.m. graveyard shift, those days appear to be no self-respecting agent wants to present that to their reality star, who of course already has millions of followers who can kind of name their price. And so instead they kind of slip into these roles because they bring, in theory, a big audience. But the purists had just take truck with this.
I mean, Caroline, it's interesting, both Jamie and Jordan have two very successful podcasts, obviously separately, and they both want to be on big mainstream radio stations. Is that cash? Is that there is still... it's still shiny enough that they want to spend their time there.
Bit of kudos.
Yeah.
Bit of future proofing. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I can remember Jimmy Mulville making this point in A Different World about BBC Three. And when the BBC made that big decision to move BBC Three to online, and Jimmy Mulville said, "You're kidding yourself. All the YouTube stars, they want to be on primetime television." And of course, not so much these days, but I think you're tapping into something there. There is just something. I guess they grew up with it. Perhaps they're satisfying their 12-year-old, perhaps even younger, 8-year-old selves, thinking, I made it to the Radio 1 breakfast show.
Yeah. You can explain to your mum what you're doing now.
It's still hallowed turf. It's still, I know the numbers are falling away as audiences are migrating to, as Kate said, podcasts pretty much above anything else. But there is still a kudos. There is a name recognition. It means that you're in the car on the way to school. It means you're reaching those parents as well as the youngsters. And I guess it kind of, it gives you a bit of versatility as an individual for then going off in different directions, because pop is a young man and woman's game.
Yes. So I think both, I was looking at the figures, and whether it's the Radio 1 Drive Time show or the Capital Breakfast show, it's about 2.5 million listeners a week. So not to be sniffed at. Solid numbers, potentially very lucrative. When I looked at what had happened, Jordan disappeared quite quickly from Radio 1, which is unusual for the BBC, very usual for commercial radio. So I think we'll find out maybe a little bit later on what happened there. I mean, it's never nice if one of your big stars ups and leaves, but is that the BBC's job to go and find the next Jordan North?
I think the BBC, I would love the BBC to be less enthralled to the inverted commas, very inverted, big names, talent, and with that, big salaries. I do think that it's the BBC's job to basically emulate that great producer, Biddy Baxter, and to create stars out of, frankly, nobodies, to look for skill sets, to look for unknowns, and to say, come and do television.
But is that harder to do now than it used to be?
I imagine it is. But also, there's a lot more YouTube to dig around in. I mean, if you're effectively a football scout, there's a whole ton more country league games to go and inspect and to find your next Jordan North. I mean, yes, he then goes off. Capital Radio has to pay him. Fine. Gary Lineker one day may succumb to the lure of commercial television.
And everyone at BBC would breathe a sigh of relief should he do that.
Well, think how many little mini Gary Linekers could be paid for with that cash.
I'm quite worried now about the vision
mini
of
Garys.
Mini Gary Linekers. And on Roman Kemp, he's sort of leaving Capital for what we expect is a TV career. He's been doing the one show. Where do you think he's off to next? What big idea do you think they've got for Roman?
Well, I'm sure that it hasn't escaped his agent's notice that Ben Shepherd recently vacated his chair on Good Morning Britain to join this morning. So there's one low-hanging fruit right there. I'm sure I think I can hear them discussing it in the ivy as we speak. But clearly,
or at least the musical chairs.
I mean, Roman Kemp, look, he's comes from sort of pop royalty. George Michael was his godfather. He has two pop stars for parents. He's done great work at Capital Radio in terms of building the show's profile and his own. He's made documentaries. It's there for the taking, isn't it? He can pretty much do what he wants.
We will see what he does. Also, the interesting thing about Roman, because his godfather was George Michael, he gets some of the royalties for a couple of George's big hits.
Amazing.
Which gives him huge flexibility with what he wants to choose to do.
Andrew Ridgeley co-wrote Careless Whisper, apparently.
Right, time for the media quiz. This week entitled Manifesting. It's all the rage these days, and we at the Media Podcast are no strangers to jumping on the bandwagon. So can you decipher the media manifestations from these cryptic clues? So what I mean is, guess the media story from what's been put in my script. Buzz in with your names if you know the answer.
Kate,
you will say... Good. And Caroline, you'll say...
Caroline.
Because of the delay on the line, Kate, you will go on my first whistle, Caroline on my second whistle. Only joking. Little gladiator's gag there. Right, so let's play Manifesting. Buzz in with your name if you think you know. Why might the revolving restaurant turn again?
Caroline. I'm being polite in case of the lag.
That's good. Go for it.
Thank you. Well, this is about the BT Tower, which has been sold, well, has been agreed to be sold for, get this, £275 million to MCR Hotels. They plan to turn it into a prestige hotel, which will bring to an end one incredibly long celebrated era where, what was it first, the Post Office Tower?
Yes, and then Telecom Tower.
Yes, BT Tower. I hope that it still satisfies some certain City of London requirements to do things with its light shows when something special turns up. My parents actually went on their very first date to the BT Tower for the revolving restaurant. My father used to make great weather out of the fact that he went with one woman, but the floor turned around and he turned around and there was my mother. I don't know how true that was. But
it's a great story.
Thank you.
So question number two, how did a local BBC weather presenter become a party pooper?
Caroline.
Shall
I take this one? I feel like I should, because this is actually my story from Deadline, which is that Causa Quaymer, who is one of BBC Northwest's weather presenters, so clearly very able at her job, but no problem there. And then she got caught up in one of those, those spontaneous chats to fill a couple of seconds before the end credits. And the host, Annabelle Tiffin, made the nice inquiry, what are you doing this weekend? And she, off the top of her head, mentioned that she was going to her niece's surprise birthday party. And of course, it wasn't a surprise anymore, yes, because she was broadcasting to the region.
It was clearly a, we've got 12 seconds to fill before we have to hop back in.
Yes, and I think there were 12 seconds that she should, she, I think there were 12 seconds that she wished she could go back up.
Heartening that in this fragmented media age, we can still ruin children's birthday parties. So maybe it's not all bad news. So congratulations, Caroline. New people to the media podcast do very well on the quiz. So from a beginner's luck perspective, well done. See if you can do it next time, when hopefully we'll have you back. And a special prize, you can help Radio 1 find next new talent.
Oh, thanks.
Excellent. That's it today from the London Podcast Studios, except, of course, that we have a fantastic offer for you. We can offer 25% off your first booking here at the London Podcast Studios when you use the code MEDIAPOD. Just head to thelondonpodcaststudios.com for 25% off with the code MEDIAPOD. If you're new to the show, make sure you've hit follow on your podcast app of choice, or hit subscribe on our YouTube channel. My name is Matt Deegan. The producer was Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio production. I'll see you next week.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.